Welcome to History Lost in Time, from one enthusiast to others.
And welcome to the episode The Communist Manifesto.
Why this topic today?
Yes, a very short welcome, because explaining the topic selection this time is important. Basically, it's the internet's fault. Do you have any idea how often I had to endure listening to nonsense about socialism and communism online in the past 25 years? It's amazing what is considered socialist and communist these days. Maybe it's worse in the US than in Germany. I mean, there's tons of people in the US that think that a national healthcare system for everyone is communist and that North European states like Sweden are socialist. Okay, fine, if you want it this way, then we'll take a look at what socialism and communism are really about. I did plan on analyzing political and historical books in future episodes, but I hadn't really thought about socialist and communist books. Why not? Because I find them unpleasant to read, as they often use unnecessarily complicated language. Now, there will be lots of examples for the German version of this episode. As I do my translations myself, the English version of this episode will have simplified language in the quotes, so just trust me on this. Or read the original yourself. I dare you.
Political background and commentary.
If you want to dive into socialism and communism, you need to start at the beginning, meaning Barack Obama and his healthcare plan. Just kidding. Obviously, it's the Red-Green Alliance and their ecological social tax reform in Germany in the late 1990s. Okay, kidding aside for real now, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. I will begin with their book, The Communist Manifesto. And don't worry, this won't be a communist propaganda festival. I have read both The Communist Manifesto and Hitler's Mein Kampf, and I have neither become a communist nor a Nazi.
The sources.
I will talk a little bit about both Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels in the beginning. I'll get the basic data from Wikipedia, but then we'll dive into the Communist Manifesto itself. The edition I have was published by the Anaconda Verlag in Munich in 2009. The original was published in 1848. Let me go back a bit. In the 18th century, most states on Earth were absolute monarchies. That means no constitutions, no parliaments, no political movements from the people. The way a state worked, how it ticked, that was depending on the monarch. So for most of the people, it mattered more who their monarch was, not which state they lived in. That's why monarchs at the time could easily conquer territory or trade it without much resistance from the local population. For example, Prussia could conquer Silesia in 1740, which belonged to Austria at the time, and the Silesians didn't care that much. On the contrary, Protestant Silesians actually preferred belonging to Protestant Prussia over belonging to Catholic Austria. So in some cases, religion was more important for the identity of people than nationality. Let's end this very, very simplified analysis here. Of course, there were exceptions. You start finding real political movements based within the people with the French Revolution of 1789 in the first parliaments. You can find three basic movements. Nationalism, meaning uniting all people of the same nationality within one state. Liberalism, which demands introducing democracy and basic human rights. And a form of early socialism, which develops into socialism and communism in the 19th century. Early socialism is a bit vague and demands equality regarding possession. Liberalism demands equality regarding rights and liberties. Early socialism adds equality regarding possession and belongings as well. Nationalism, liberalism, and socialism grew in strength in the 19th century and are still very strong today. In the early 19th century, there were many large and small groups of all three major ideologies in many countries. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels were both German journalists and philosophers that belonged to the Communist League when they were young. Together, they wrote the Communist Manifesto in 1847-48, which is one of the basic documents of socialism and communism. I was surprised by the small size of the book. It is a very small booklet with barely 80 pages, but that does actually make sense. If you want to make communism popular in 1848, you need to publish a compact, quick-to-read booklet, not a massive book with 1,000 pages. This had the advantage that I could read it quickly. When I progress to the capital of Karl Marx, I won't have that advantage anymore. The book has 4 chapters. On page 7, it starts with the famous words, "A specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism. All powers in old Europe have banded together for a witch hunt against this specter, the Pope and the Tsar, Metternich and Guizot, French radicals and German policemen." Here you can already see that this book isn't like a timeless Bible for communists, but that it is rooted within its time. Metternich, the Tsar, that alone shows the age of the book. The goals of the book are described on the same page further down. It is high time that the communists explain their ideology, their purpose, their tendencies to the world, and confront the tales that the world powers have spread about the specter of communism. For this purpose, communists of different nationalities came together in London and designed this manifesto, which will be published in English, French, German, Italian, Flemish, and Danish. So the main purpose of the book is to explain to the public what the communists actually want, and thereby gain control of the public discussion about communism. Okay, so let's take a look at what the communists want. In chapter 1, Bourgeois and Proletarians, Marx and Engels describe their own view regarding the history of the human race. Class struggles are always at the center. On page 11 you can read, "Free man and slave, patrician and plebeian, baron and serf, guild member and journeyman, in short, oppressor and oppressed, have always confronted each other. This always led to uninterrupted conflict, sometimes open struggle, a struggle that always ended with a revolutionary change of the entire society, or with the collapse of all struggling classes. Just like other extremist ideologies, communism explains the entire world from a single point of view. While National Socialism puts race at the center of everything, communism focuses on class and class struggle. Everything else is just decoration." Marx and Engels say that the society that existed in 1848 was born from the class struggle of the nobility and the bourgeoisie, and in this society the bourgeoisie and the working class are facing each other. The age of the bourgeoisie is primarily a capitalist age, which improved industry and production, expanded it, developed new markets, and continuously renewed itself. Here we see the main difference to earlier ages, where economic revolutions just didn't happen. So this is mostly correct, as the age of industrialization had the characteristic that the world in which an old person lived was no longer the world in which that person had been born into. Marx and Engels continue saying that the bourgeoisie had destroyed the old feudal system and replaced it with its own structures. They accuse the bourgeoisie of being very brutal in that. While the age of the nobility still used religion or political illusions to justify oppression, the bourgeoisie didn't do that and instead oppressed and exploited the workers directly, openly, and without shame. However, the capitalist system required permanent renewal and growth in order to survive. It says on page 16, "The need for continuous increase of sales for their products makes the bourgeoisie chase around the entire earth in search of new markets. They have to settle down everywhere, build everywhere, make connections everywhere." In the next paragraph, Marx and Engels accuse the capitalists of 1848 of globalization already, since the capitalists had destroyed old national industries and replaced them with international interdependent structures. That's why they say that the working class also has to act on an international level, and that purely national strategies will not help the workers. That explains why communists always acted internationally, and why they were always confronted with the accusation that they were people without a motherland. However, from a communist perspective, that is a necessity in order to fight internationally active capitalists effectively. Marx and Engels also accuse the capitalists of forcing their way of life, both economically and privately, on the entire world, even on societies they call barbaric or half-barbaric, while also increasing the urban population and decreasing the rural population. The capitalist system would go through crises and collapses in a cycle which is part of the capitalist DNA and cannot be prevented. The capitalists would survive crises in the same way over and over again, shrinking the economy and conquering new markets. For a capitalist, a worker is just a resource that is used when required, discarded when convenient, and paid as little as possible. And the exploitation of the worker continues outside the factory by the hand of traders, house owners, and other businessmen as they try to squeeze as much money out of the workers as possible. Marx and Engels recognize the existence of classes other than big capitalists and workers. For example, they have a class called petty bourgeoisie, which basically consists of craftsmen, farmers, small business owners, etc. But they consider only workers to be a revolutionary class, while the rest has basically made peace with the capitalist system and only wants small or even reactionary changes. For Marx and Engels, the main strength of the workers is their sheer numbers. Quote from pages 29-30. All earlier movements were movements of minorities or for the interests of minorities. The proletarian movement is an independent movement of the overwhelming majority for the interests of that overwhelming majority. The working class, the lowest class of today's society, cannot rise without blowing up the entirety of all classes above it, which form the official society. And just in case blowing up wasn't clear enough, here is another quote from page 30, which should clarify what Marx and Engels have in mind. By pointing out the general phases of the development of the working class, we documented the more or less hidden civil war within the existing society up to the point where open revolution breaks out, which ends with the violent fall of the bourgeoisie and the establishment of the rule of the proletarians. The key word here is violent fall. Marx and Engels don't see a chance for a peaceful change in society. And if you want a wonderful example of overly complex language, I dare you to read the original. So for Marx and Engels, the proletarian revolution is unavoidable. Capitalism requires a large working class, so the more capitalism develops forward, the more it needs additional workers. So basically, capitalism is creating the very thing that will destroy it, according to communist ideology. In chapter 2, Proletarians and Communists, Marx and Engels explain what separates communists from other working class parties. Quote from page 35. The only difference between communists and other proletarian parties is that, 1. They highlight and support the international interests of the entire proletariat within different national proletarian struggles, and 2. They support the interests of the entire movement in the various phases of struggle between proletariat and bourgeoisie. And yes, that was a single sentence. In the German original, it has 6 sub-sentences, so be happy I translated it myself and simplified it. That's the kind of simple language I very much appreciate within socialist literature. So let's work through this. The main point here is the fact that the communists support the interests of the international working class independent from national issues. So communists consider themselves to be an international group. That explains organizations like the Socialist International and the global network of socialists and communists in the 20th century. That fact is already part of socialist DNA in the Communist Manifesto. On page 36, the primary goal of the communists is mentioned. Forming the proletarians into a class, fall of the rule of the bourgeoisie, conquest of political power by the proletarians. Okay, so far no surprise there. But how should things continue beyond that? Next quote, same page. What characterizes communism is not the abolition of property in general, but the abolition of bourgeois property. On page 37, Marx and Engels defend this goal against expected opposition. People have said that communists want to abolish personal property, the property that is the basis of liberties, activities, and independence. But does wage labor, the work of a proletarian, create property? Not at all. It continues on page 38. The wage of a worker is barely enough to ensure survival. So the argument of the communists is this. They want to abolish bourgeois property because what the workers have is nothing more than the existential minimum and not worth anything. The true property is owned by the capitalists and therefore should be nationalized and used by everyone. Marx and Engels later claim that 90% of the population have no property anyway and therefore don't need to worry, as they basically have nothing that could be taken away from them. They then face the argument that this kind of lack of ownership would lead to laziness and lethargy. In very complicated words, and at least to me, not very convincing ones, they just claim that this wouldn't be the case. However, we have the blessing of late birth and thereby know that communist planned economies were very inefficient and either collapsed or were reformed, like for instance in China. Marx and Engels then also confront the accusation that communists want to destroy families. Their reply is that workers don't have families because of their deplorable existence, while the bourgeoisie is preaching morality but living immorally. Obviously, they don't back this up with any proof. Then they confront the accusation that they want to take away the motherland from the workers, with the counterclaim that workers don't have a motherland, and that nation is a bourgeois concept that would vanish once communism was established. Then they name a rather concrete 10-point plan. Let me sum it up in simple words. 1. Nationalization of all real estate property and introduction of a real estate tax. 2. Introduction of a strong progressive tax. 3. Abolishment of inheritance. 4. Confiscation of property of rebels and emigrants. Emigrants, not immigrants, so people that have left the country. 5. Centralization of all banking within one monopoly state-owned bank. 6. Centralization of all transportation. 7. Expansion of industry. 8. Forced labor for everyone. 9. Merging of industry and farming. 10. Public free of charge upbringing of all children and abolishment of child labor. So they want to abolish the right to own real estate, the concept of inheritance, and all free economic activities. Banking, transportation, free industry, free farming, all abolished. And the destruction of families is actually there in point 10. They talk about public upbringing of children, not education. And there is forced labor for everyone, however, at least not for children. In the next chapter, Socialist and Communist Literature, Marx and Engels talk about competing socialist movements of the time. It seems to be a constant within left-wing movements of all times that they divide themselves over issues and concepts that appear bizarre and barely comprehensible to outsiders. They talk about feudal socialism, petty bourgeois socialism, German socialism, conservative socialism, and utopian socialism. Feudal socialism seems to be a movement of the nobility that was crushed by the bourgeoisie in earlier revolutions and now tries to appeal to workers with thoughts about the good old pre-industrial times. Petty bourgeois socialism seems to be basically social democrats that want to change society with small evolutionary steps. Marx and Engels disapprove of German socialism completely and just call it dirt. Conservative socialism sounds a bit like the green movements, because on page 63 Marx and Engels call them an alliance of economists, philanthropists, humanitarians, improvers of the situation of the working classes, charity organizers, abolishers of animal cruelty, founders of temperance societies, and reformers of the most colorful and mottled kind. Finally, it looks like they consider utopian socialism to be early socialism. Here they criticize that the socialists of that age wanted to achieve their goals by peaceful means. Quote from page 67. This chapter can only be understood properly if one knows these socialist movements well, but introducing them is beyond the scope of this episode. However, the gist of it is, Marx and Engels consider themselves to be the only true socialists and everything else is crap. On the final pages, Marx and Engels explain that they are keeping their eye mainly on Germany as they expect that it is quickly approaching revolution. That was actually correct, as there was a revolution in Germany in 1848, However, we know that feudal structures remained alive in Germany until 1918. Following that, they say that communists support revolutionary movements anywhere in the world. The last paragraph reads like this. The communists disdain to conceal their views and intentions. They openly declare that their aims can only be achieved by the violent overthrow of all previous social orders. Let the ruling classes tremble before a communist revolution. The proletarians have nothing to lose in it but their chains. They have a world to gain. Proletarians of all countries, unite.
Finishing words.
So this is the Communist Manifesto. And are we all communists now? Probably only if we were communists already. Therefore, I suggest being brave and reading this stuff yourself, even if you don't agree with it. And for a very specific part of my listeners, I wish to highlight that healthcare wasn't mentioned once, just FYI. What is mentioned instead? First of all, an explanation of the entire world from one point of view, the point of view of class and class struggle. From this point of view, workers are good and everything else is either evil or, like other socialist movements, at least misguided or even harmful. The capitalist system is explained in very brief form, and both capitalists and workers are then categorized in very simple ways. In such a black and white, good and evil worldview, you obviously cannot cooperate with evil, so you have to work towards its violent fall. This is mentioned several times. So communism is about confrontation, not understanding and reconciliation. Additionally, communism is international, not national, and wants to abolish basic concepts of society, like ownership and nation. However, it isn't explained how this is supposed to happen, and the book remains rather vague there. Did they know themselves? Did they try to avoid explaining the idea of an all-powerful state and an all-controlling party? Or did they really believe this would all solve itself somehow? This remains unclear. It's only clear that they thought very little of competing socialist movements and that their main focus was industrialized Germany, not agrarian Russia. And that's basically all you can get out of this manifesto. You can already see some characteristics and weaknesses of real socialism of the 20th century. And looking back, it is quite easy to spot these weaknesses. However, one thing should be clear. Marx and Engels really wanted to improve the world. They didn't plan to create autocracies that oppress people with gulag systems and secret police forces. They wanted to improve the living conditions of workers, and to be honest, the living conditions of industry workers of the 19th century were really horrible. However, the main errors of Marx and Engels were basing their philosophy on struggle and confrontation, not on reconciliation, and having an idealized and ultimately wrong image of humanity in mind. This kind of philosophy doesn't attract peaceful aesthetes, but the complete opposite. So we shouldn't blame them with the mistakes of real socialism, that's unfair. We should blame them with the basic errors of their concept. When it comes to real socialism, don't worry, there's enough literature there that I can talk about. Lenin, Mao, they wrote enough. I can and will discuss that as well, and there we can see how they justify themselves and how their words and actions match or differ. But that's material for future episodes, and this should be all regarding the Communist Manifesto.
Thank you for your interest.